Managing is mostly concerned with controlling the work of others and yourself, but leadership involves being in front and inspiring others, not just throwing work at them. Make no mistake, if you're a project manager, leadership is a vital part of your role. You can plan well, but if the teams don't work well, then you're going to have problems. The good news is that team members, with a few exceptions, want to do a good job, so you will be working with them, not against them. You know yourself that you are the most satisfied when you have achieved something and done it very well. Your team members feel the same, and there lies one of the keys to effective project management. Your team members are like you. Too many people go through a strange metamorphosis when they're appointed to a management position, a bit like Jekyll and Hyde, or Harry Enfield's sketch of Kevin's 13th birthday when he turns into a teenager. Then they think that staff should be treated very differently to how they like to be managed when they were in that position. To be effective yourself, it helps to stand back a bit and analyze what makes someone a good leader and manager, and also what makes for a bad one. Although this section goes on to spell out the factors, you probably already know most, if not all of them, from your own experience of being managed. So, think back to those who've managed you. Who did you like working for? Who managed you so that you could give your very best? And what were the characteristics of their management styles? Then, think about managers who weren't so good, who closed you down and made life difficult. What was it about those poor managers that made them poor? Try these management characteristics. Good managers are cool-headed and rational when problems crop up, are supportive and available, give opportunities and challenges, have a clear sense of direction and communicate objectives well, have a sense of proportion so minor problems aren't treated as crises, plan well so their staff aren't forever racing to meet unrealistic deadlines, recognize and show appreciation of good work and extra effort, respect their staff, trust and give responsibility. Value the views of the staff, even if the manager finally disagrees sometimes. Bad managers are control freaks and micromanagers, are emotional, including regularly getting angry and having emotional highs and lows, are power hungry and play power games, don't listen to their staff, focus on the task only at the expense of the staff, find fault and apportion blame if things go wrong and even if they don't, take all the credit for achievements. How do I become a good manager, you might ask? On one level, the answer's easy. You emulate the things that you've seen in good managers and avoid the things that you've seen in bad managers. You know the things that helped you give your best, and when you really wanted to do that because you enjoyed what you did, and you also know the sorts of things that closed you down and made you want to give up and go home early. Some people think that leadership is great and people will follow if you're going somewhere nice and the journey there will be pleasant. That's not true, however, and leaders can inspire people to follow them and endure even hardship. It can be difficult to lead if team members are senior to you in experience and also in age. It may help to remember that projects are all about roles. Your role is to manage. That doesn't mean that you're inferior or superior to any team member, just that your role is different. To get a job done, you need authority, and it will help you in the project if you think through just where that authority comes from. The very title, project manager, gives authority, and everyone knows that the project manager has day-to-day responsibility for the project. A natural respect and compliance follows from team leaders and team members who can see from the project organization structure, even if they haven't already realized, that they're accountable to you. Unless you give the team's reason to challenge that inbuilt authority, then you can expect it to stand. As the captain of the ship, you have initial authority on two grounds. Appointment. Unless your project is very small and in your own area of work, more senior managers will have appointed you to the role of project manager. That appointment itself displays their confidence in you and reflects an authority within the organization. Delegation. This project is being run for the organization, not your own ends, and was commissioned by a sponsor or perhaps even a more senior group such as a management board. You're running the project on behalf of those who commissioned it, and therefore you have their authority, not just your own. Both of these grounds add to your confidence in your position because you're backed by authority that is higher than your current position. That point should help too when you come to manage more senior people who are working on your project. To have a healthy project that stays on schedule, you need motivated staff who will work well in terms of the quantity of work they do in a given period and the quality of it. Remember, if the quality is poor, that affects the project schedule as well as the end product because of all the correction and retesting. So what makes for good motivation on teams and within the project as a whole? There have been many books and theories on motivation over the years, but one of the simplest and most powerful models is from Fred Hertzberg, an American psychologist who became a leading light in management practice. Fred Hertzberg's model is great for management and is highly relevant for creating productive project teams. Hertzberg says that people will normally give an average performance, something he calls the Potter line, where people potter along doing what they think is a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Things like money, good working conditions, and company cars, he argues, won't motivate people to give more than an average performance. You may know yourself, if you have a company car, for example, that when you first got it, you were delighted, but very quickly it became part of your normal environment, and now you jump into the car and really think about when you didn't have it. Fred Hertzberg called things like fair pay, good working conditions, and company benefits hygiene factors. Where Hertzberg differs from many management experts is where he says you can't neglect these hygiene factors or you drag performance down below the Potter line. You need to have good working conditions for your teams, so fight hard to get them if you need to. Try to make sure that team members are paid properly for the work they do. However, important though these things are, they don't motivate. Hertzberg argues that the motivators are things like achievement, recognition, doing sensible and worthwhile work, having responsibility, moving on in a career with promotion, and having opportunity for personal growth. It's those things that make people, including you, perform above the Potter line. Clearly then, if you want good team performance, you need to build opportunities for achievement and personal growth into the way that you allocate your project work. If you always give someone boring, meaningless work that provides no interest or challenge, don't be surprised if your project performance indicators show that person pottering along and not having the drive and productivity you're really looking for. If she's paid poorly and sitting on a broken chair in a drab, beaten-up office as well, then you can confidently look forward to productivity well below the Potter line. The causes of demotivation have also been identified with a useful demotivation model. The model has the three elements of putting in the effort, seeing the result, and then getting recognition and reward. Working hard and not seeing a result is demotivating. Taking the opposite perspective, a research scientist who keeps on experimenting but doesn't see any result for some years has to be very highly motivated to keep going. Or someone puts in the effort, sees the result, and then nothing. Nobody notices, and nobody offers any reward for all that effort. That's demotivating and is highly likely to affect performance adversely on future tasks. As a project manager, you can do something about both breakpoints and so do much to avoid demotivation. First, considering Hertzberg's point in the last section about meaningful work, try to design tasks on your project so that team members see an end result. Then, when that result is forthcoming, give recognition and, if it's within your power, reward. You can at least recognize achievements, even if you can't influence reward. Merely assigning people to tasks doesn't create a project team. A team is a collection of people who are committed to common goals and who depend on one another to do their jobs. Project teams consist of members who can and must make a valuable and unique contribution to the project. Just how much involvement you will have in creating effective teams depends on the nature and particularly the size of your project. If you're in a large project, you will have team leaders who are primarily responsible for the team-building aspects. However, even then, you have a role in establishing a project identity and encouraging team leaders in their team-building work. You may even get involved in assisting with the team-building, such as by going along to give project briefings. If you do have team leaders, your leadership role must tread the normal, careful path in management of being supportive and engaged on the one hand, but not interfering or undermining team leader authority on the other. In a smaller project, you may be running the team, and in that case, the team-building work falls entirely to you. A team is different from other associations of people who work together. For example, a group consists of people who work individually to accomplish their particular assignments on a common task. A committee consists of people who come together to review and critique issues, propose recommendations for action, and on occasion, implement those recommendations. Develop the procedures that you and your teams will use to support the day-to-day work. Having these procedures in place allows people to effectively and efficiently perform their tasks and to know how to communicate. In turn, that clarity will help avoid misunderstanding and conflict and will contribute to a positive atmosphere in the project. At a minimum, develop procedures for the following. Communication. These processes involve sharing project-related information in writing and verbally. Communication procedures may include how to address special issues that arise, such as on technical matters involved with the development. How to set up regularly scheduled reports and meetings to record and review progress, warn of problems and newly identified risks, and communicate suggestions and ideas. When and how to document informal discussions. When and how to use email. Which types of information should be in writing, and what can be reported or discussed verbally. Conflict resolution. These processes involve resolving differences of opinion between teams regarding project work. You can develop the following conflict resolution procedures. Standard approaches, normal steps that teams take to find a solution. Escalation procedures, steps to take if the people involved can't readily resolve their differences. Decision-making. Develop guidelines for choosing the most appropriate approach for a situation, including consensus and decision by technical expert. Also develop escalation procedures, the steps you take when the normal decision-making approaches get bogged down. Think long and very hard to keep written information to the minimum. Written communications all contribute to project overheads and also sap your team members' energies if they're forever having to complete project documentation instead of getting on with the job. Be careful and monitor how much of your time and that of your project staff is consumed in project overheads rather than in delivering the project's products. When team members trust each other, have confidence in each other's abilities, can count on each other's promises, and communicate openly, they can devote all their efforts to performing their project work instead of spending time dealing with interpersonal frustrations. One approach is to guide them through the following commonly used phases. Forming. This phase involves meeting team members and discussing project objectives, work assignments, and so forth. Share the project plan, introduce people to each other, and discuss each person's background, responsibilities, and areas of expertise. Forming is something you may want to do project-wide, not just within each team. Storming. This stage involves raising and resolving personal conflicts about the project or other team members. As part of the storming stage, do the following. Encourage people to discuss any concerns they have about the project plan's feasibility, and be sure you address those concerns. Encourage people to discuss any reservations they may have. For example, a junior and inexperienced team member may feel nervous being surrounded by highly qualified specialists. Focus these discussions on ways to ensure successful task performance. You can initially speak privately with people about issues if they're uncomfortable about bringing them up in front of the entire team. Eventually, though, you must discuss their concerns with the entire team to achieve a sense of mutual honesty and trust. Norming. This stage involves developing the standards and operating guidelines that govern team members' behavior. Encourage members to establish these team norms instead of relying on the procedures and practices they use in their normal functional areas. Examples of these norms include the following. How people present and discuss different points of view. Some people present points of view politely to the point of understating them, and others enthusiastically debate things to the point of appearing aggressive as they work to resolve points. Participation in meetings. Some people sit back and observe, and others actively participate and share their ideas. The norm will be to encourage active participation. Timeliness of meeting attendance. Some people always show up for meetings on time, but others are habitually 15 minutes late. set the norm for this project, which of course will normally be that people show up on time or everyone's time is wasted. Performing. This stage involves doing project work, monitoring schedules and budgets, making necessary changes, and keeping people informed. Teams won't automatically pass through these stages. They have to be guided. As the project manager, you will need to periodically assess how the teams feel they're performing. Again, if you're working with team leaders, then you may want to do this mostly through them by checking things out at a team leader's meeting. But nothing is as good as a first-hand view. So schedule time to go and see how each team is getting on. Adopt the MBWA style, which is management by walking about. You don't have to say much, except to encourage and show interest, but you can observe. Here are a few pointers. Are the team members upbeat and cheerful, or are they downcast and gloomy? Do the team members show an active interest in the work when you ask them about it, or are there signs of disengagement and just going through the motions? Are they working together, or is everyone isolated and working on their own, even when they're supposed to be building products together? Is the work area organized and tidy, or cluttered and disorganized? How do team members seem to relate to the team leader? Is it happily as a colleague, or are there signs of reluctant obedience, or even disrespect? For example, if you see the team leader speak to a team member, perhaps to ask something, what does the team member do when the team leader turns away? Watch out of the corner of your eye. Don't look directly. Does the team member simply get on with the work, or does she look across at another team member and raise her eyes to the sky? It's a common mistake to think of conflict as always being something bad. If conflict is destructive, then certainly it's negative, but positive conflict also exists. Positive conflict is where two team members disagree and fight it out, but both thoroughly respect the other's view, and often both have great fun arguing the point through. This sort of conflict drives analysis deep, and when the outcome is finally agreed, both team members are fully confident in it. Strangely, people who get on together too easily, who tend to see things the same way, or who cave in at the first hint of an opposing view, can end up with a superficial result that hasn't been properly thought through or challenged. However, the conflict is time-consuming, so who you put on a task depends on the importance of that task, how soon you want it finished, and how important it is for the outcome to be right. A critical design product may justify putting staff onto the work who are going to see things differently and who are strong characters. They'll go deep. Deciding on which order to paint the three inner walls of the stationery cupboard probably doesn't justify too much in the way of conflict and deep discussion. So, yet another dimension for your resource planning. There's a lot to project management, isn't there? If you don't have team members who see things differently, you can engineer the situation by getting one to deliberately attack a product, such as a design, to see whether the other person can counter the arguments. Or you can get everyone to take on the negative stance to try to spot the problems with an idea or a design product. A final word about leadership and motivation is a reminder to keep your teams well motivated and encouraged throughout the project. Getting your team members to appreciate your project's value and feasibility helps you build initial enthusiasm. However, if the project lasts longer than a couple of weeks, the team's initial momentum can die without continual reinforcement from you. In general, people working on a particular task need to know how they're doing over time for three reasons. Achieving intermediate milestones provides personal and group satisfaction. Recognizing their successes confirms to people that they're on the right track and motivates them. Successfully completing intermediate steps reinforces people's belief that they can accomplish the final goals. Part 4. Steering the project to success. Chapter 13. Tracking progress and staying in control. Having planned your project and started it off, you now need to keep your eye on the ball and keep it on track. All projects experience problems, but far too many project managers don't detect that things are off the plan until the deviation is severe. At that point, it's much harder and sometimes impossible to put right. It's a bit like walking across some open moorland. If you go a couple of degrees off course and you detect this quickly, you need take only a few steps to get back on track. If you don't find out for several hours that you deviated by 2 degrees, well, you get the picture. When you run your project, you can be very sure of one thing. It won't go exactly to plan. That makes it all the more important to identify deviations from the plan promptly so that you can react quickly and make the necessary corrections. There are three underpinning elements for effective progress control. Those key things are having a good plan, having clear and frequent milestones, and then putting in place an effective progress reporting mechanism. Knowing that projects just about always go off track could lead the less well-informed to think that it's not worth spending much time on planning. Actually, the opposite is true. The fact that the project is going to go off plan means that the plan is even more important. When a large ship sets out on a voyage, it has a sail plan that shows the planned course to the destination port. However, this course is the one route the ship is guaranteed not to follow. Winds and water currents will push the ship off course. However, the planned course is all the more important because that's what the ship will constantly correct to in order to ensure that it arrives safely at its destination. You need a plan, then, but if the plan itself is unrealistic, incomplete, and superficial, then clearly it's going to be next to useless for control. The plan isn't just some luxury that, in an ideal world, projects really should have if they have the time to create them. It is essential for effective control. The plan must also be up to date, within a few days at least. If something is reported as off track, then you need to be able to assess the impact and work out your options. If you last updated the plan 7 weeks ago, it isn't going to be a lot of help in planning where to go from here because you won't know where here is. Get into the discipline of updating your plan once a week with actuals of what has been delivered, the timings of those deliveries, and what resource, including staff time, has been expended. To know for sure where you are, you need milestones. The deliverables or products in each stage form natural milestones and so provide an excellent foundation for progress control. When you're using a computer-based project management tool to maintain the plan, it will track progress on the Gantt chart using percentage complete for each activity. The percentage complete is shown with a solid bar in the middle of the activity bar filling up like a thermometer. Clearly, you aren't going to have good progress control without an effective reporting mechanism accompanying it to show you when the project reaches milestones. If you aren't using products, then you'll need regular estimates of progress from those doing the work. If you use products as milestones, then you need a mechanism to flag up when products have been delivered. A product is complete when it's been quality checked and signed off. If it hasn't passed test yet, it isn't complete. The progress tracking mechanism of percentage complete on activities does have some problems. The mechanism is known to be unreliable because at best it's based on an estimate, and at worst, team members exaggerate the progress they've made. Using products as a progress measure avoids the problems of estimation for progress reports. With products, progress isn't a matter of estimation, but a matter of factual reporting. Which products are complete, quality checked and signed off, and which aren't? That gives you and the project sponsor or steering committee an accurate statement of exactly where you are in the stage and the project. A work checklist is an extraordinarily simple device, but a very powerful one. It's just a list of products to be produced in a stage, together with a product's target delivery dates, and then, when they are complete, their actual delivery dates. You can also add a column for the variance between the two. The checklist shows clearly what has been delivered, when, and how the date compares with that on the plan. Remember, a completed product is one that has been quality checked and signed off, so with a work checklist, you know that products have been confirmed as meeting their specified quality requirements. They've not been thrown together and finished in a hurry. Most experienced project managers agree that the first sign of trouble on a project isn't overspending, as many assume, but rather slippage on delivery. In the context of delivery, the work checklist gives even more value as a monitoring tool. Now you've seen the work checklist and the progress annotated workflow diagram, you can fully understand why frequent milestones are a great idea and why all products should be milestones. It isn't onerous jotting down the date of delivery of a product and altering the color of its symbol on the workflow, and in return you have extraordinarily precise progress tracking information based on factual reporting of product states, not complete or complete, not on someone's guess of percentage complete on an activity. Monitoring and reporting progress is often at stage level. However, sometimes project sponsors, steering committee members, and others in the organisation, such as management board, like to see project-level progress, the big picture. That's no problem, and you can colour-code the workflow diagram in the project-level plan as well as the stage-level diagrams. Equally, if a team is working on a complex work package, a work assignment, to build a product or a group of related products, the team manager may well have drawn up a more detailed plan. This lower-level plan will include a workflow diagram at a more detailed level still than the stage-level plan. If there is a lower-level workflow diagram, this too can be used for progress monitoring, where the project manager is keeping tabs on the progress of individual work packages. Projects are always going into the unknown to some extent, and you can almost guarantee that your project won't go exactly the way you thought. If your project doesn't go exactly to plan, don't panic. That's normal. You need to, 1. Find out why the project is off track, 2. Look at all the things you could do, 3. Decide which action or actions you're going to take, 4. Take the action you've decided on, 5. Monitor to see whether the actions are working. If the steps are not working, go back to step 1 to find out why, and follow the other steps through again. In a panic, project managers often leave out the first 2 steps and jump into step 3, but that's a big mistake. It's all too easy to rush into an action when actually that action isn't the easiest, cheapest, or most effective. Knee-jerk reactions are rarely the best ones when dealing with project problems. When you hit a problem, first look for the underlying causes and try to understand the characteristics of the problem. This may well involve talking to a team leader or two, and perhaps some team members and external supplier specialists. In the case of a problem affecting the overall running of the project, perhaps it would be good to have an informal chat with a sponsor or 1 or 2 members of the project steering committee as well. It's only when you properly understand both the characteristics and the causes of deviation from the plan that you can come up with sensible corrective actions. Ask the following questions. Is the project off track, or is the project right, but the plan is unrealistic? You may need to adjust the plans for the rest of the project in the light of this experience. Is this a problem with planned work, or has extra necessary work been discovered that wasn't anticipated on the plan? Is there a problem because the work requires more effort than expected, or is it that the team members haven't been able to put in the planned time? Are the team members going more slowly than expected because of unfamiliarity and inexperience? Would it help to ask for more experienced staff, or would the learning curve of new staff getting to understand the project only make things worse still? Have the teams been held up because necessary equipment isn't available? For example, delays in other projects have held up the release of equipment. Is the problem because something is more complicated than anticipated? Does that mean that other products will also be more complicated? Is this problem a one-off problem that affects only this part of the work, or is everything going to take longer than expected? Is the cause of the problem something you can control, or is it, by its very nature, outside your control, such as higher than normal sickness levels due to a particularly nasty bug circulating? Is the activity on a critical path? Delayed activities on a critical path will delay your overall project schedule. If the activity is on the critical path, you'll need to take more extensive control action than if it has spare time that can absorb some or all of the delay. Is the activity on a path that's close to being critical? Activities on non-critical paths can have some delays before their paths become critical. Has the work already been identified as involving risk? If so, have you got some management actions planned already and set down in your risk register? Have you already encountered problems with this activity? Unless new factors have arisen, the recurring problem suggests that previous control actions aren't proving adequate. It's important to think wide when considering possible actions to get a project back on track. A common knee-jerk reaction is to throw more staff resource or money at the problem, but that isn't always the best thing to do. Indeed, for some problems, putting more people onto the work just makes matters worse. A great help is to bring in the team leader and possibly team members to talk about the problem. It's often the case that team members themselves can see solutions, especially if they're technical experts and have been there, done it, and got the T-shirt. When considering your options for bringing the project back on track, include the following in your thinking. Use contingency to absorb an overrun if the activity has no float. If the activity is something that you can't put extra people on, just accept the fact. It's what contingency is there for. However, if you're unhappy that it's taken up too much of your contingency for this point in the project, you may be able to buy back some contingency time by putting more staff on a later activity and so shortening its duration. Split the work. It may be that part of the work must be done now, and although it was preferable that the whole job was completed, in fact some of it can be done later in parallel with other things. Having considered a range of options for action, now's the time to make your mind up on what action or actions you're going to take. Your decision is likely to hinge around three factors. What you think will be the most effective, what the cost is likely to be in money and staff time, what the impact on other project work will be. For the last of these factors, your plan needs to be up to date. Computer tools can really come into their own when looking at impacts, because you can do what-if projections using the tool. Having reached a decision on what to do, perhaps in consultation with the steering committee if the deviation is significant, you must now adjust your plans to include the actions. You will then adjust the work in line with the revised plans. In some cases, after the control action is put into effect, that's the end of the matter. But in many cases, you need to check whether your actions are proving effective. If the actions are working, that's all well and good. But if not, you'll need to look at why that is, see what range of actions are now possible in the light of this new information, choose what to do, yes, go through all the steps again. Then monitor again. If the new actions aren't working too well either, then you go back around the steps for a third time. Progress monitoring is very important to be sure that you deliver on time. However, progress isn't the only thing to watch. You also need to keep an eye on work effort and costs, which of course are related. It may be that products are being delivered on time but are taking more work effort than expected. Comparing work effort expended with work effort planned can highlight when people are cutting corners on quality, encountering unexpected difficulties doing the work, incorrectly expanding or reducing the scope of an activity, more or less qualified than anticipated. To monitor work effort, you need to collect data on the actual effort spent on each activity to build each product. Good computer tools often produce timesheets at the click of an icon. If you use the computer to print out the timesheets, you make life easy for your team members who just need to fill in the remaining information each week. They'll be much more open to providing information for you if, in turn, you've made the reporting as easy as possible for them. If you decide to use percent completed alongside product delivery to monitor progress, because it's included in your software package, be careful. It's not a reliable way to indicate progress. For example, saying that your new product design is 30% complete is virtually meaningless, because you can't determine objectively how much of the thinking and creating is actually done. Suggesting that you've completed 30% of your design because 3 of the 10 days allotted for its performance have passed is equally incorrect. The first indicator is a measure of resource use, and the second is a measure of time elapsed. Neither measure indicates the amount of substantive work completed. Alongside tracking progress, you must monitor your project spending to verify that it's in line with the plans, and if it's not, to address any deviations. You may think that you can determine project funds used to date and funds remaining just by reading the balance in your project's financial account. However, if you're working in an organization of any size, spending project funds usually involves several steps before an item is actually paid for. In particular, you need to discriminate between money spent, money committed, an order has been placed but the bill hasn't been paid yet, and money not yet committed. To keep control of project spending, you need to compare the amounts it was planned to spend with the amounts that were actually spent. There's usually no need to get complicated about it, and you can set up a simple report format using a spreadsheet. You may spend more or less money on your project activities than you planned, for the following reasons. You receive the bills for goods or services later than you planned, so they're paid for later than you planned. You buy and take delivery of items early, or just prepay to receive special discounts or sale prices. you don't need certain goods or services that you budgeted for in your plan. You find you need goods or services that you didn't budget for in your plan. Even if spending is greater than planned for this point, it may still not be a problem. An important check is whether the spending is overspending or something that has been bought in advance of what was originally planned. In the case of early spending, the stage or project will actually finish close to target, but in the case of overspending, then clearly it won't. Before developing a way of monitoring the project expenditures, first check the nature and capabilities of your organization's financial tracking system. Most organizations have a financial system that maintains records of all expenditures. Often the system also maintains records of accounts payable. Unfortunately, many financial systems categorize expenses by cost center but don't have the capacity to classify expenses by components within a project. And if that's true for your organization, then you need to find something else to provide the additional detail you require. Another important area of control in your project is change control. Look out, there's a project killer about, and its name is scope creep. Scope creep, as the name suggests, is a change to scope, but it's made up of small movements. And actually, small is the problem. Many small changes build up to represent a very big amount that the project can't absorb and which proves unmanageable and so fatal. So what's the answer to scope creep? Simple. Change control. Note the word control. We're not talking about change prohibition. In fact, prohibiting change in the project is usually damaging, but sometimes it's impossible anyway. The thing to try to eliminate isn't change, but uncontrolled change. You might think that you don't need change control because you don't want to allow changes at all. If so, consider correction of mistakes, compliance with the new standards, and taking on board good ideas that will improve the project. Different types of change are significant because you may fund them in different ways. Where something has been delivered by a supplier and it's wrong, then it needs to be changed to be put right. If the original specification is clear, then the cost of this corrective change will fall to the supplier. But when the change is because the project customer has had a change of mind, or something has changed in the business environment, then the cost of that change will fall to the customer. When additional work falls to an external supplier as a result, there will normally be an additional charge. To get a change, it has to be asked for, considered, approved or not, and then implemented. By definition, if you want to avoid uncontrolled change, there needs to be control. You can do this very simply with the use of a change request form. But of course, this can be electronic and sent by email. It doesn't have to be paper. A change request should set down basic information, but that may be supplemented by the project manager after the request has been analyzed. It should have basic information included on what and why as a minimum. In some cases, until some exploratory investigation has been made, it may not be possible to say exactly what's involved in making the change. Basic information includes name of the person asking for the change, date of the request, description, including impacts of making the change, reason for the change, including advantages, or saying if the change is mandatory. This information may be recorded in a change log and then supplemented with more information and the eventual decision on the change request. Work needed to effect the change. Decision taken to agree the change or refuse it. Date the change request is closed. Having a change log is really helpful in the project because it gives you an overview of the change requests received and what is happening to each. You can use a spreadsheet for your log, and then you have the advantage that it can be sorted in different ways. For example, you may normally keep it so that live changes are at the top and closed change requests that have now been dealt with are sorted to the bottom. Do bear in mind that you may need to consult other people about a particular change request, such as technical experts on teams or the sponsor or steering committee members, if it's something that requires authority beyond your own delegated authority, such as the change being high cost. Don't forget to allow for that time and involvement in your plans. In the same way that you need to set aside some time in the project for dealing with changes, so too you're going to need some budget. If there's no change budget, then any change request will have to go to the sponsor, because by definition, it's not on the plan that the sponsor originally authorised. How much there should be in a change budget depends on two main factors. The first is the amount of change anticipated in the project, and the second is how much the sponsor wants to delegate decisions to the project manager. The sponsor can set two dimensions on a change budget, a total amount and an item amount. So, for example, the project manager must go back to the sponsor if the total changes exceed a limit of £25,000 or for any single change that will cost £5,000 or more. Some people and many senior business managers live in a comfortable rose-tinted world where project changes can be absorbed with no impact. Sadly, projects happen in a real world with some very real change dynamics. If you have an effective change control system, you can handle very big changes as well as the small ones. In the case of a big change, you can adjust the project plan and stage plans to accommodate the additional work. In that way, the extra time and resource are allocated and the project brought back into balance. This section on change started with a warning that scope creep is a major project killer. In surveys of the causes of project failure, expect to see scope creep in the top five reasons, and frequently in the number one slot. Two elements of project management help you almost eliminate scope creep. The first is a change control procedure. The second is clear, precise, and agreed definitions of project deliverables. Chapter 14. Keeping everyone informed. Communications are a major source of problems in projects and are a factor frequently cited as a common cause of project failure. Such failure is unnecessary, though, because having good communications just needs some thought up front. Some projects are like a walk in the dark for the people taking part in them. They have some idea of where you're going at the outset, but then there is an information blackout. In your project, you want things to be different from those walk-in-the-dark projects. In fact, effective communication, getting the right information to and from the right people in a timely manner, is a key to successful projects. Good communications need to be balanced. The answer to under-communication isn't over-communication. As you'll readily appreciate if your email inbox is bulging each day. Communications are a common area for problems. You don't need to think for long about day-to-day life, let alone projects, to remember misunderstandings even over simple communications. Sometimes such misunderstandings can be funny, such as the Chinese Whispers party game, where a spoken message is passed around a circle of people, and the final version, usually hilariously, bears no resemblance whatever to the original. Funny at a party, perhaps, but potentially extremely serious in a project. Communications problems are particularly significant, though, when you see the results of surveys into failed projects. Communications failure doesn't always take first place as the most common cause, but it's always in the top few, and frequently it does occupy the number one slot. Good communications need careful thought, and the emphasis must be on appropriate communication, carried out intelligently. Coming to the specifics of projects, what, then, are the particular underlying causes of communication problems? A lot of communications problems result from unclear roles and responsibilities, where people involved in the project don't have a clear understanding of what they should be doing and are even less clear on what other people in the project are supposed to be doing. Small wonder, then, that things drop down the gaps. Avoiding this problem is straightforward enough. If project staff are absolutely clear on what they should be doing and are equally clear on the roles of others in the project, the potential for communication difficulties is immediately reduced. Great misunderstanding arises in projects over what people are to deliver. It's all too easy for people to use similar words but have different ideas, or simply to make assumptions that the other person is thinking along similar lines. This is a serious communications problem because misunderstanding over deliverables or products leads to confusion, wasted work, frustration, and project delay. It's not the conscious assumptions that are the problem in communications, but rather the unconscious ones. You can record conscious assumptions so everyone can see them. For example, this plan is based on the assumption that the government grant will be authorised and the funds will be available at the start of the new financial year. Unconscious assumptions are those that, by definition, you don't realise you're making. You just understand something and don't realize that you've misunderstood. It's impossible to eliminate unconscious assumptions, but you can work, think, and cross-check to reduce the number you make. You'll do more damage to your image by pretending to have understanding when you don't than by swallowing your pride and asking the dumb questions. Don't risk making dangerous unconscious assumptions simply because you haven't checked the facts with perhaps a junior team member. When information is really important, it's helpful in a conversation to feed back to check your understanding. So many misunderstandings go undiscovered because people don't use the simple mechanism of feedback. It doesn't have to be difficult or embarrassing. You can simply say, "That's really important. Now, can I just go back through it to make sure I've got it absolutely right, and you can tell me if I've misunderstood anything?" That gives both opportunity and permission for the other person, even a very junior team member, to put you right if you've got something wrong. Keep in mind the amusing words of author Robert McCloskey. "I know you believe you understand what you think I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant." In your project, it helps to think through each element of the communication to understand it and then decide the best means of communication. For example, who's receiving the message? If you're communicating with technical staff, be careful not to talk down to them and explain matters when they have much more knowledge than you. On the other hand, if you're talking to trainee user staff, don't have unrealistic expectations about the amount of understanding they have of the business process you're dealing with in the project. Obviously, you're going to have to spell things out and check to be quite sure they understand. Some communications are one way, and others are two-way. One-way communication. Going from the sender to the receiver with no opportunity for clarification or confirmation that the receiver got and correctly understood the intended message. This type of communication can be effective for presenting facts, confirming actions, and sharing messages that have little chance of being misinterpreted. One-way communications are either push, proactively distributed to particular people. Examples include memos, reports, letters, faxes, and emails. Pull, available to people who must access the communications themselves. Examples include internet sites, knowledge repositories, and bulletin boards. Two-way communication. Going from the sender to the receiver and from the receiver back to the sender to help ensure that the intended audience received and correctly interpreted the intended message. Examples include face-to-face discussions, phone calls, in-person group meetings, interactive teleconferences, and online instant messaging. Two-way communication is effective for ensuring that more complex content is correctly received and for conveying the sender's beliefs and feelings about the message. The one skill that most strongly influences the quality of your communications is your ability to listen actively. Good listening skills are important to be sure that you're hearing correctly what others are saying to you, but are also important when you're checking the response of the other person to ensure that she's heard your message clearly. Be especially careful to listen in those cases where you disagree with someone. It's fine to disagree and even to come into healthy conflict. The danger of having even a healthy argument, though, is that you're so focused on getting your next point clear in your head that you fail to take on board what the other person is saying. Instead, slow down. Listen very carefully to what the other person is saying. Then, don't be afraid even of leaving a short silence while you think about what the other person said before making your next point. Listening is important to help you understand, but as a byproduct, it also has a powerful effect on those you're communicating with. Even if people disagree with you, they're much more likely to accept your authority and overruling of their points if they think that they've been heard. It's incredibly frustrating if you believe you have an important point, but a key decision maker hasn't taken the trouble to even listen to you. You know that you would be impressed, too, if, when you're arguing with someone, she listens very carefully to each point that you make and stops to think about what you said before making her next contribution. When deciding how to communicate with different people in and around your project, choosing the right medium is as important as deciding what information to share. Your choice of medium helps ensure that people get the information they need when they need it. Project communications come in two forms. Planned communications will be conducted in a form that you have to think through, even if only briefly, in advance. Examples include weekly team meetings, stakeholder briefings, and monthly progress reporting. Ad hoc communications occur as people think of information they want to share. These communications occur continuously in the normal course of business. Examples include brief conversations by the water cooler and spur-of-the-moment emails you dash off during the day. Both planned and ad hoc communications can be either written or oral. Beware of making an assumption that project communications all need to be written. Some communications may be carried out verbally, such as some of the reporting. The following sections look at major communications options. Unlike informal oral communication, written reports enable you to present factual data efficiently. Choose your words carefully to minimize misunderstandings, provide a historical record of the information you share, and share the same message with a wide audience. Written reports have benefits. They also have drawbacks. They take time and effort to produce, so you need to think carefully about the frequency of regular reports. They don't allow your audience to ask questions to clarify the content and meaning of your message. With written reports alone, you can't verify that your audience received your message as you intended. They don't enable you to pick up non-verbal signals, and they don't support interactive discussion. You often don't know if your report was even read. To maximize the chances that people will read your written reports, make sure that they are clear, concise, and worded in a way that the readers will understand. If you were presented with a report that was full of jargon you didn't understand, how likely are you to put it in the pile to read later? Only pressure of other work means you never quite manage to. Progress reports are some of the most important reports you have in the project. Progress reports operate at two levels, from team leaders to the project manager, then from the project manager to the steering committee, perhaps copy to others as well. Typical progress information will be delivery, products produced in the stage to date, schedule, whether the project is on time, budgets, what staff, time and money has been used so far, and how that compares with what was planned to be spent by this point. You might also show the spending against the total for the stage. For example, saying that spending has now reached 40% of the stage total. Performance. How teams are performing against estimates. Are things taking more time than expected, less, or is performance on track? Risk management. Current status of key risks and brief information on any new ones. Other information, such as on significant problems currently being addressed, or any other information of which the recipient of the report needs to be aware. Few words elicit the same reaction of anger and frustration than the word meeting can provoke. People consider meetings to be everything from the last vestige of interpersonal contact in an increasingly technical society to the biggest time waster in business today. Meetings don't have to be painful experiences, though. If you plan and manage them well, meetings can be a highly effective and concise form of communication. Meetings you may want to hold in the project include ad hoc team meetings to discuss a problem with something being developed and get everybody's ideas for the best way of dealing with it. Project progress meetings with a sponsor or steering committee, often every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, to talk about progress and the outlook for the next period. Regular team meetings, often held weekly within a team to discuss progress during the week and talk about the work in the coming week. Stakeholder meetings, to keep stakeholders up to date with what's going on in the project and help maintain interest, enthusiasm, and a positive outlook. Workshops, perhaps to sort out technical details such as a specification, but also useful for project planning, such as holding a risk workshop. Following on from the earlier point that not everything has to be written down, consider the following options. A website where people can find project information. A short presentation with slides rather than a report. The telephone. With the diversity of people who will be looking for information about your project and the array of data that you will be collecting, it's helpful and sometimes essential that you prepare a project communications management plan, comms plan for short, to record what communications are to be made and how. As with most of project management, the comms plan isn't difficult. As you come to think about project communications, it can be helpful to break them down into three areas to give more focus and structure to your thinking. Within each of the